Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
In the past month, a new wing opened in St Vincent's University Hospital here in Dublin. It's going to benefit a wide range of patients with state-of-the-art facilities spread over four floors. And right away, Orla Tinsley moved into a bed in the section of the new wing reserved for patients suffering from cystic fibrosis. It was a very emotional day for Orla. Indeed, it's been an emotional few weeks for her, her family and all the staff and patients at St Vincent's. Since 2005, Orla has been a campaigner for the rights of people with cystic fibrosis and has made the care of CF patients a national issue. I'm delighted to welcome her here this morning with her parents, Brian and Patricia. You're all really welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
No, it's my absolute privilege, Orla. Look, I know a lot's been written and said about it, but for you personally, tell me about the day the unit opened, what it meant to you, what it was like.
Oh, it was incredible. I've just come from there now, as you know, after 5.5 weeks in hospital. So after the first 3 weeks, it actually opened and we moved over, and the night before we were told to pack all our bags up and everybody was texting each other so excited, and it's kind of bonkers to be so excited about a hospital building. But the morning we got into the lift and went up to the second floor, and when the doors opened, the ward sister was there to greet me as I went in, and I walked along the corridor, and there's two parallel corridors with 10 cubicles on each side, and my cubicle was at the very end, so I got to see along the way the sort of silhouettes of the people in the cubicles before mine, and I caught the eye of one of the CF nurses and she said, "Don't look at me," because I was ready to start crying. You know, it's the most incredible moment and so surreal and so wonderful for so many people.
And you're still in Vincent's at the moment.
Yes.
So how much has it transformed, for instance, your life just even in there?
Everything is in the one place, and, you know, all of the treatment for CF is in the same area. So the staff are all, you know, there if you need them at any time, and you don't have to worry about cross infection or, you know, other people in your room or other people's needs. You just have to worry about yourself and getting better. Mm. And you also have that personal space where you can, you know, listen to music or read or, you know, have some quiet time with your family, and all these things that just make it a lot easier to be in there for such a long, long time.
What did it mean for you two, Brian and Patricia, for the unit to open for Orla?
Well, like Orla said, it really is amazing. I'm just listening to Orla and thinking back there that when Orla and all people with cystic fibrosis were promised that this development would take place. And I don't know, how many years ago was that, Orla?
Well, it's been ongoing, but I remember actually on your program on Primetime, they promised in early 2008, I think,
yeah,
2009.
And
yeah.
I suppose the particularly amazing thing at that time was that it was promised it was about to happen. And then just at the 11th hour, suddenly it wasn't going to happen. Mm. And that, I think, catapulted Orla into a new attempt to make sure, in fact, that it would go ahead. And I think it took about a week before this government decision to not go ahead with this was reversed. And I suppose an interesting thing about that was that they decided then. It's amazing how pressure creates creativity. And they were very innovative in how this building would actually be built, mm-hmm. in the sense that the cost of the building, as I understand it, would be borne initially by the builder, and it wasn't until it was completed that that they would have to pay out. So I hope we have the money to pay out now.
Yeah. From your point, I mean, Patricia, we all worry about our children, and obviously has it made you feel less worried about her sometimes that she's even now in hospital in a beautiful place and she's not hopefully going to get as much infection as she did in the past?
Well, I feel, Miriam, that now she's in an isolated area, which is the ideal situation for anybody with CF, that she is now going to get better quicker and less outside influences, and she's going to just get on with it and hopefully get out quicker. I know she's in hospital a long time this time, but she's been particularly sicker this time. But yeah, I think it's going to be so much better for anybody with CF, you know, and they're going to get better quicker and they're going to have better facilities, and it's just fantastic. It's just really brilliant. And to walk in there, the night they opened, Orla rang us and said, we're going to have a party in my room on Tuesday night. So we brought up
pink lemonade.
Pink lemonade and chocolate cake. And Orla's aunt made some buns, and we arrived up with all the goodies. And some of her friends came, and it was fabulous. It was just such a moving moment, really fantastic. Yeah. You know,
for the whole 4 or 5 days the first 4 or 5 days it opened, every single person who came into the room, including the consultant, had big red eyes from just the emotion of it. Just what you were saying, Dad, about, you know, kicking into action. There's so many people who have kicked into action over the years. So many people who've given themselves. A lot of people who, you know, are not here now to see the fruits of their labour, the work that they've done. And, you know, it wouldn't be possible without them. It's been something that before I came along, people were going on different shows and talking about it. For some reason, when I started writing about it, it clicked and people started listening. But there's been so many people before me, and, you know, there have been so many people since I began as well. And it's been such a group effort. And that's why I think it's succeeded, because people just didn't give up, you know.
And even in our town, you know, people stopped me on the street and said, oh, I saw Orla on the news. Isn't it wonderful that the unit has opened? And how is she? And how are things? And does this make it better for them? And everything, you know, everybody's so interested.
Which is your town again?
Newbridge, County Kildare.
I mean, I'm looking at you now, Orla. I said it to you when I met you today. Yeah. You look the picture of health to me, right? You look absolutely beautiful and healthy. But what is, briefly, what is CF? Like, what is it?
It's a genetically inherited illness that affects different organs in the body, basically the lungs and digestive system. And there's a buildup of mucus in the organs, which causes infection and scarring, and, you know, affects different parts of the body over time. Like, you know, the pancreas doesn't work properly, and some people get diabetes and are not able to digest food properly, so they need enzymes. And so it's something that's a prolonged illness that there's no cure for. And as you get older, it does get worse. So having treatment in a proper facility is just wonderful, because you know that, you know, there's a lot of things you can't control and you can't do anything about them. And that's something that you have to deal with. But having proper treatment is not something that you should have to worry about controlling. Mm. It should just be there. So it's really great now.
Brian, when Orla was born, when did you first realise that she had CF? And did you know anything, either of you, about CF?
Well, Orla had made a very exciting debut in this world, in that she was, I suppose the first thing was that she was premature by, I think, about 10 weeks. And she was rushed, literally rushed to hospital around midnight, I think, one night. You know, there were problems straight away. And then initially we thought there were problems with prematurity.
But it's your first baby, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And then gradually, you know, it became a little bit more clouded. We weren't sure. And at that time, the only test, and Patricia would know this stuff better than me, but the only test for CF was a sweat test. And I think it had to be sent to Britain, you know, to get this test. And that was a 6 weeks test. But I think my memory of it is we got it quicker, that she had what was known as a meconium ileus, which is a blockage of the bowels. And that is a significant factor or indicator of CF. So eventually, we were told the news and had to deal with that then, you know.
Yeah.
And Patricia, were you about 6 years waiting?
Yes, we married in 82, so we had Orla in 87. So we had been trying. Well, we weren't trying initially for a baby, then eventually we were trying, and I gave up cigarettes, Brian gave up cigarettes. we got it right eventually, and I was pregnant with Orla and had a very uneventful pregnancy. I continued to work, and actually the night I went into labour, I was working in Vincent's Private, or the Matter Private at the time.
What do you work at?
I'm a nurse.
Nurse, yeah.
And there was a rugby weekend on, and I remember the girls said, we're going over to Jury's for the aftermath. Are you coming? And you can stay in my place. And I said, no, I think I'll go home. Yeah. So I drove home to Newbridge that night, went home, sat down, put up my feet, and had my Philadelphia cheese and crackers, which I normally
have, by the way, now.
Yeah, that's so nice. It's in the womb.
Yeah. And Brian was up painting the nursery, and I just started to bleed. So we got ourselves to Hollis Street, and I went into labour, and then I stopped labour, and then I went into labour the following day and produced this lady by section. So to cut a long story short, as Brian has just explained, she was very sick initially because of her prematurity, and then she wasn't getting any better. So they didn't mention CF to us. And I had known about CF before because I did my midwifery training in Drogheda. And during that time when I was there, there were several babies born with CF, about three or four. And we didn't know what CF was, but we looked it up and we thought, oh, that's a rather strange illness, you know. We didn't want to know about it really, because you're so busy when you're young and single, you don't want to know about half those things. So then when Orla was diagnosed, Orla was transferred to Temple Street, and we were told that the possibilities, there was a high incidence that she would have cystic fibrosis. And we were shocked, and I was shocked because I knew this was not good. So we went home the first night and we looked it up, and we were quite shocked and didn't know where we were going to go with this. We knew there was a short life expectancy, and we were very worried. We were really very worried. But Orla was very sick for the first few weeks, and then she turned the corner.
I suppose a significant factor in that was that when Orla had this operation, which it was the first operation of its kind, as I understand it, for the meconium ileus, and I think it was Professor Fitzgerald that carried that out. But on the night that he carried it out, he called us, and it was fairly grim news at that stage, because he said more or less that he didn't think Orla would make it, and that was at 11 o'clock at night or something like that. And we were kind of looking at the next morning that was, you know, that she wasn't going to be long in this world. And but by morning, she had just inched a bit forward and
rallied. Look at her now.
Yeah, she's a tough cookie.
Did it change life? Somebody said to me actually that you basically almost altered your lives almost to make Orla as well as she could be. Did it transform your lives, Orla's birth and her illness?
Well, I wouldn't say that's absolutely true, because in a way, obviously, you have to adapt to it. But right from the very start, I suppose both Patricia and I were agreed that we were going to live, if you inverted commas, a normal life. Yeah. This is part of our life. And we went and lived life to the full, and have and still live life to the full, and will continue to do so.
I suppose we thought Orla was our first child. We had nothing to go on. So therefore, let's go. Now, this is Orla, and CF is such a... there was a lot of negativity out there about CF. Mm. So we thought, well, we're just going to be positive about this.
I think we felt that by us doing that, that Orla would benefit from that, because if she was going to be made different or feel different, or, you know, any type of negativity, that's going to rub off on her. Yeah. For, you know, it's a simple concept.
It clearly worked.
Well, we just felt we'd be positive here. Let's get her as well as possible. We do all the right things, and she's going to live a very normal life, the same as everybody else. We're not going to cocoon her.
Yeah. At what stage, Orla, as a little girl, did you realise you had an illness? Did you become kind of conscious of it even, if at all?
It's very strange. I mean, I always talk about my earliest memory with CF was when I was about five, and a young girl who, she was 13 at the time, so she was older than me, was in the room in hospital across from me, and I used to go in every day and try and paint pictures with her, and the nurses would yank me out of there, and they would go looking for me during the day, and they'd find me, and they'd be just frustrated because she had CF as well, but she had a different bacteria to me, so being five, I didn't really understand that I shouldn't be in there colouring. And one day she just was gone out of the room, and she passed away basically, and it registered with me, and I probably knew that we had some sort of commonality between us, but I didn't know really what that was, but it definitely was something that was my first memory kind of CF. But at the same time, Temple Street Children's Hospital is an amazing hospital, and you don't really feel sick when you're there as a child, because you have a schoolroom, you have a playroom, you have these incredible staff there who just keep you up and happy the whole time, you know, so you just feel like...
Such a nice tribute to the hospital.
But it's so true, and that I think that really, really helped, and of course my parents as well, who
it was your second home, really.
Yeah.
You know, it really was. Orla spent so much time of her life in Temple Street. I think she spent her first Christmas there.
Yeah.
And Santa Claus used to arrive in Temple Street as well. It was amazing how he knew where to go. But anyway,
he's very clever, Santa.
He is exceptionally clever.
Were you, when you're young, because I know you're a very sensitive person just from your readings and listening to you. Were you conscious that you were worried when you were younger about your parents when you got sick? In other words, when you get sick, you have to worry about yourself. But do you also worry about your parents worrying about you?
Yeah, I was really, because my parents sort of taught me to be so positive when I was younger, I was really bad at accepting negativity. So if people were negative or sad, I'd be like, you know, it's going to be okay, it's fine. And I think we all kind of picked each other up. But I think that's what I was like when I was younger. And I also loved doing theatre and things like that. So I was always just kind of very happy. But I think as I got into my teenage years, you know, my hormones and everything, I got kind of angry at people who were negative, you know. You're trying really hard to just get on with your life. And if you see people who are taking things for granted, you kind of feel like you want to say, why are you smoking? Why are you?
Yeah.
But then you get a bit older and you think, you know what, people, that's their business.
Choice.
You know?
Yeah.
Which brings us nicely to our first piece of music, which is yours, Brian. What, it's a Bizet piece. Tell me about this.
Oh, well, when I was first asked about it, I kind of, you know, what piece of music would you like? It's like looking at a big box of chocolates, you know, so many. And Habanera came into my mind. I think as a young chap, I had an eclectic sort of interest in music and lots of music. And for a young guy, you know, opera or that type of thing was maybe a little bit unusual. But Carmen, the whole thing, I found it exhilarating, exciting. You know, it's something, it uplifts me. And yet it's got, you know, serious undertones to it, as you know, in the opera. But it's just a wonderful piece of music and I really enjoy it.
And we have Maria Callas sing it this morning. Maria Callas there, beautiful singer, singing Habanera from Carmen. For you, Brian,
you
were surprised he chose that order, weren't you?
I was very surprised. I was wondering why you'd chosen it.
Well,
you did explain.
Hope you like my answer.
But you know one thing, because you're a nurse, Patricia, does that make you deal with it better or does it worry you more because you know so much about it? In other words, is it a good or a bad thing that you're a nurse?
I suppose it's good and bad. The advantage was that I knew much more about all his medication and I knew how important it was. Like every mother who has a child with an illness knows when they're told that if they have to have kids have to have medication, that you must give it on regular times. But I sort of knew that there was a huge advantage, I suppose, in being a nurse and the physiotherapy aspect of it, the medication, keeping her well. also the negative, the downside would be the possibilities of not survival. You always knew those things. You knew much more from the layperson who wouldn't have known, like, what was going to happen, the complications of some of the medications. I remember when Orla was a baby and she was in Temple Street, she was on very strong antibiotics, and I thought, oh my God, the side effects were deafness. And I remember I got her a little pink musical thing, and I used to go in myself and shake it at her ears to see what her response was. And she was very small and long-limbed, thin little thing, and she always responded. So I thought, oh, her hearing's okay. This is me just testing for
doing
myself.
Doing your own test.
Yes.
And you have one other child. You went on to have another child, your brother, or
yeah.
Yes. What's his name?
Jack.
And how old is he?
He's 18. He's
19.
Oh, he's 19. Oh my God.
Yeah.
He's 19. He's I feel old. But he just did his leaving cert, actually. I know.
How did he do?
Really well. He did really well. Yeah, he got 565 points.
Oh, my Lord.
So proud.
He's a genius.
He's a genius.
That's particularly because he had what's known as a pneumothorax during the year, which meant that he lost about 5 weeks.
What's a pneumothorax?
His lung collapsed. His lung collapsed.
Nothing to do with CF. He's just very long-limbed, and it's typical of that.
Tall young boys, when they're growing, sometimes their bodies grow at different paces, so it can happen.
He doesn't have CF.
No.
Were you worried that your second child might have CF?
Initially, yes. But I felt this guy, he was so active when he was in utero that he was so active, I didn't think there was anything wrong with him. And then when I saw him...
Typical
boy. I know. Yeah. When he was born, I thought, oh God, this guy is... There's nothing wrong with this guy.
He was about five sizes bigger than me.
And I licked him when he was born.
Aww.
Because people, babies with CF are very salty. Because they have a high sodium content. There's a bit of a myth about that.
It's a way they used to test for CF in the years ago. They used to check the salt levels. And
That's, of course, why your book is called Salty Baby.
Yes.
That's so amazing, though, just even you licking.
I just thought I'd try, I'd do this. But I knew by the look of him.
Yeah.
And then he had to have a check. He had to have a sweat test.
Yeah.
And that was negative.
But mum's so amazing. She always, I gave her such a hard time as a teenager because she was in this role where she was my mum, but she also had this nurse component that she didn't turn off because she cared so much, and so she knew so much more than me, and it drove me mad. And now I'm so grateful. And
you know more than me now.
I know, but I'm so lucky that I had that because, to have her have that knowledge and love me so much as well, just to be able to look after me like that and deal with me as a teenager trying to, move against that and not take my medication and do these things.
And were you difficult as a teenager?
I was difficult, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. You can tell it now because she's great.
Well, she's no more than any other teenager, I'm sure, but the other component of CF.
Mm. How do you mean, was she difficult?
But one of the things about Orla, we did home IVs on Orla. So she had her antibiotics at home.
Yeah.
She has a line in her chest, which allows us to give her intravenous antibiotics.
Hmm.
And in lots of cases, I used to put in the cannula into the port that she has in her chest. And I used to hate doing that because I always felt, this is my daughter. I'm sticking a needle in my daughter.
Hmm.
And I used to take on my nurse attitude when I was doing that. Now, sit up there and stew, be calm, blah, blah, blah. And we had this cream called the magic cream that we put on to deaden her skin.
Yeah.
So
I still use the magic cream.
still use the magic cream. So that I found that awfully hard because I sometimes look at myself doing this and think, here I am sticking needles in my daughter. But we got over it and we just got on, and Orla starts just all that herself now.
Yeah.
Even I became expert at doing home IVs, which was incredible for a guy who used to look the other way past in the hospital, So, but the other thing was the physio. And I mean, from a toddler onwards, Orla had physio three times a day. And, the technique has changed very much since then, but it meant putting Orla on pillows or across your lap, facing downwards, chest downwards for drainage and what they call a clapping motion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I even when I clap sometimes, I still have my hand cupped. it's the way we used to do it.
It's wonderful now, though, that, all these things can be done independently by teenagers, even from the age of 10 up, are being taught how to do these things themselves. Mm-hmm. So they have so much more independence, and that really frees you up because you feel more, you know, in control of your situation.
Yeah. Tell me about your background, Brian, where you grew up, your family.
Well, I grew up in Newbridge, went to school in Newbridge and started out life in sales generally. So I've worked in sales and marketing. I've worked in quite a mixture of jobs. We were in business in Newbridge. We had a retail shop in Newbridge there for a number of years. And in more recent years, I've worked in the disability field as a director of corporate services and, you know, various, I suppose, managerial jobs in that field.
Your mum died when you were very young. How old were you?
Oh, I was just, I barely remember. I remember just lying. I remember when she was dead, as a dead person lying in a bed. And that's my only real memory of her. So I was, you know, 2 or 3 or something like that, you know.
And what happened to your mum?
Her heart gave way, you know, so.
We have a beautiful picture of her, though, in the most elegant Oscar Wilde-looking dress and hat. You know, that sort of the importance of being earnest dress. You know, she's beautiful.
They were so elegant back then. Yeah. They wore the hat and gloves.
I should say my father married again and, you know, obviously had a stepmother and had a great relationship with her. She has since passed away also, but that was quite good.
And your Auntie Breege.
Well, I have my Auntie Breege, or Auntie Bee, as we call her, up in Donegal, who is 97 years of age.
We've got to say hi to Auntie Breege.
It. I'll tell you, this is hard to believe.
Yeah.
But I was up there with one of my brothers there last week, visiting her.
Oh. And is she your mother's sister or your father's sister?
Your mother's brother's wife.
Right. Yeah. Always tells me.
Well,
but she knows, I ran around the glen up there where she lives up in Donegal, but she ran about 30 or 40 yards with me.
Age 96.
97.
Yes. I want to know her secret. 97. What's she on?
We all want to know.
Maybe it's
fresh air.
Living in Glen in Donegal. I'm not too sure.
She's on moving up to live in the Glen with her. Yeah. And what's your background, Patricia? Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Newbridge also.
Where? You didn't go far to meet love.
No. I grew up in Newbridge and in the town of Newbridge. And then my parents had a business there. And there were 6 of us in the family. And I was number 3. I always say the middle child.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 brothers and 3 sisters, and or the 2 sisters. So then I went nursing. I'm trained in St. Michael's in Dunleary. And I left home at about 18. I thought I would never come back to live in Newbridge. So little did I know I was going to meet a man from Newbridge.
Where did you meet him?
I met him, he was a friend of my brother's, but I knew he existed. And then I met him one night out in the rugby club. I was going to Australia. I bought my ticket for Australia. So I started socialising in Newbridge. I never socialised in Newbridge because when I left at 18, my life began, I thought. And then I went out with my brother and all his pals and met this guy.
And?
I wasn't very impressed with him.
The word I heard was arrogant.
Yes, well, he was extremely. I thought he was extremely.
And I was just being funny. I thought.
I had nothing to lose. I thought because I had my ticket in my back pocket.
Why were you going to Australia?
Just to see the world and get on with life. My plan was, if I liked Australia, I was going to stay.
Can you imagine any woman leaving me?
And obviously, she didn't, Brian.
She came back.
She got sense. Did you go?
Of course, I went to Australia. Yes,
yeah.
I went to Australia. I was there for a year.
But did you think of Brian when you were away?
I did. Yes.
And what did you think of her when you met her?
Careful.
Yeah, he's posing. He's a real man. Actually,
the most beautiful creature I've ever seen.
That's the right answer, Brian. Oh, no.
What I liked about her straight away was that she had a sense of humour.
Yeah.
Which I think was required for maybe my odd sense of humour at times, you know. And that kind of attracted to me. Patricia had written to me when she went to Australia and I think I must have lost my pen or something and didn't manage to reply. So she didn't bother writing again. And then she sent a postcard, about 9-10 months later or something like that. And I was walking down, I hadn't heard about her, so I assumed she had forgotten about me. Walking down the street in Newbridge and there's this shop that was closed and, you know, closed sign on it and was gone out of action or whatever. I was walking by and there was a glass door and I looked through the door and I could see a postcard. It was near the flat that I was living in at the time. And I could see the colour on the foot. It was Ayers Rock, you know, the famous Ayers Rock. I said, hold on, that's that place in Australia. Who do I know in Australia? So I got a wire coat hanger, pushed it through the door, hoping the cops were around, pulled out the card, and Dear Brian.
Wow, it had
gone. And that was there for months,
place.
You know. So that kind of ignited things.
Aww. But look, we're going to take the next piece of music. Tell me about why you love It's a Woman's Heart. It means a lot to you, doesn't it? Yeah, tell me about it, Orla.
We go to Temple Street Hospital a lot when I was a kid, driving up and down from Newbridge. And one of the only cassettes in the car was A Woman's Heart. So my mum forced me to listen to it. And I grew to love it so much. And
I loved it.
Mum loved it so much, yeah. And actually, we went to the 20th anniversary there a few months ago and sat in the front row and cried our eyes out. It's wonderful. It's one of those incredible memories that we have of bonding together, really. And it's just really
special.
We used
to sing it together in the car.
Well, because we knew you loved it so much, we've actually got Eleanor McAvoy, and she's going to come in now and sing it live for you.
Goodness. Oh, my God.
Eleanor, come on in. There she is. Oh, hey, Eleanor.
How are you doing? Nice to meet you.
You too.
Nice to meet you.
Hi.
That's so nice of you, Eleanor. They really do love it. That's a little surprise.
That's incredible.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm definitely going to cry now.
Well, we certainly cried last year when we were at the concert.
She's great.
You couldn't bring in Maria Callas, obviously.
Okay, Eleanor, in your own time.
My heart is low, my heart is so low. There's only a woman's heart can be. There's only a woman's, there's only a woman's, there's only a woman's heart can know. Tears that drip from my bewildered eyes, taste of bitter sweet romance. You're still in my hopes, you're still on my mind, yeah. And even though I manage on my own, my heart is low, my heart is so low. It's only a woman's heart can be. It's only a woman's, it's only a woman's, it's only a woman's heart can know. Restless eyes reveal my troubled soul, memories flood my weary heart. I mourn for my dreams, I mourn for my wasted love, and while I know that I'll survive alone. My heart is low, my heart is so low. It's only a woman's heart can be. It's only a woman's, it's only a woman's, it's only a woman's heart can know. My heart is low, yes, my heart is so low. It's only only a woman. It's only a woman. It's only a woman's heart can know.
You made us all cry, Eleanor.
Thank you.
It was beautiful, wasn't it?
It was incredible.
Nutshell. We've 2 tickets as well for you for the next lot of gigs in the
LMB.
Oh, wow. And I have the new single, The Secret of Living Free, as well. It's a brand new song.
Thank you so much.
With all the crew on it.
When are you going to the LMB? When is the next reunion?
28th of August till the 2nd of September.
Yeah, thanks so much, Eleanor. It just meant a lot. Thank you for coming in.
It meant so much.
Privilege. I was in tears listening to you outside.
Wow, it's
that's
a funny
house. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Incredible.
That means an awful lot to me that the song meant so much to
me.
Oh, no.
Orla just said, Orla couldn't get out of the car, you see. She was trapped in her seat. So I had to sing all the way. By the time we got to the Red Cow, we were into a crescendo.
You know, we'd have good days and bad days. And sometimes, you know, it's not always possible to be positive all the time, but that music would always uplift us. We'd always feel better after it. So it's that healing power of music. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, she's wonderful. When and how did you start writing, Orla?
I started writing when I was very, very young. My dad really, really encouraged me. He was really into writing and telling stories and reading. And he used to always, you know, before bedtime, tell me a story he'd made up himself. And it kind of stuck with me. And I don't know a time when I didn't write, to be honest. I always had a pen and paper, and I don't know what I wrote about when I was a kid, but I wrote my first short story when I was in third class, and I won a competition for it. So I thought I was great, and I kept writing.
And was that something you consciously wanted her to do, encourage her to write and stuff, Brian?
Well, I wanted to encourage her imagination and create it, as most parents would. And I think I referred to the physio earlier on, and that was a perfect scenario for telling stories. And I remember, I'm sure all of you remember Sally and Silver. Sally and Silver was a continuing kid story that lasted about 2 years. So I think I might write it down sometime and try and sell it, you know. But it was, and in the stories, you know, there would be positive things in the stories. You know, there would be that sort of thing. I mean, we'd be conscious of the fact that she was going to have to deal with something quite considerable in life, you know, that a lot of people wouldn't have to deal with. So I think I had that level of consciousness, you know, that she would, that there would be, it would increase her creativity, but there would be, you know, there would be positive elements in it. Yeah.
Did you worry at all when she first started to write publicly about her own illness and her own experiences? Did you worry about that, Patricia, or that she'd be strong enough, I suppose, because she got so much all positive reaction, but still a lot of reaction in the media and public reaction?
Yes. Well, it was something Orla felt she had to do. And I remember having a discussion with her. We were chatting one day and she said, I have to do this, Mum. I feel I have to do this. And I said, well, you have to do it. Just go ahead and do it. But you would wonder about the negativity sometimes. There was a little bit of negativity. I remember getting a phone call from somebody and she said, why don't you move out of Ireland if the facilities are so bad here?
Somebody actually ring?
Yeah, somebody said that. When we were talking, she rang to congratulate Orla on something that she'd written, and then she said, why don't you consider moving? Would you not move to England? And I said, well, why? Why should we move to England?
Yeah. That's exactly it. I mean, I used to get asked that in interviews sometimes. I'd say, my friends are here, my family are here, I want my future to be here, why should I leave, you know? Why should I leave just because I can't get treatment that I could get in Northern Ireland or the UK or the US? And if I left, after starting campaigning, people would say, well, you know, you've done so much, why don't you leave now? And, you know, and I'm like, but you can't just leave halfway through something, you know what I mean? You have to just see it to the end.
I think one of the main things we worried about was Orla after a while in her writings, our media, the various media she was involved in, was that she would be defined by her illness. And I think this is something that has bothered Orla as well, you know, that she doesn't want to be defined by the illness, but how can you not be, to some extent, to have such a public profile? And of course she is a lot much more than CF.
It's funny, because I used to have that issue with myself. I used to think, oh, you know, I couldn't let it go because it wasn't finished, and then what if this is all I'm known for? Because I always said growing up, and my parents always said, you know, I wasn't going to be defined by my CF, and it wasn't all I was. It was a part of me, but it wasn't who I am. But it's funny because the more I campaigned and actually writing my book as well really, really helped me see that only I could set those limits for myself. So people around you are going to react whatever way they're going to react, but you have to just be true to who you are, you know, and you have to tell yourself, okay, I've done this now. Now I need to move on to the next thing. And, you know, I can do other things, of course. But it's just about, you know, being positive about it, I think, and working hard.
Your book was great. Did you find that, I don't know, cathartic, such a cliched word, but did you find it an important thing to do, to write down so much in the book?
It was really important, yeah. It was important for so many reasons, because when I started campaigning was the first year I started in college, actually. I started in college just after campaigning. So I my whole degree, I'd been campaigning and I had all these different things going on. And, because I was quite angry when I started campaigning, I think justifiably so. And I think as I went on and as my illness changed as well, I think I became less angry and more compassionate and just more aware of so many things that I didn't really see before and of the things that I can't control, you know. With CF, there's so many things, like sometimes you just randomly cough up blood and you have to just stop everything you're doing and go to hospital, and it might not stop for a while or it would stop straight away, but you have to just kind of learn, okay, this is something I can't do anything about, you know, and you have to kind of find that peace in yourself that allows you to just be at one with the moment that you're in and be thankful for it and know that you can't predict the future and you don't know. And, you know, I don't make too many plans, but I hope, you know.
Are you religious?
No.
Are you, Patricia?
I am, yes, yeah. I'm Catholic, practicing Catholic. All the kids, both kids, but we're Catholics. But I would say that I pray a lot. I wouldn't be OTT, but I go to the chapel, I go to Mass, try to go every day when I'm not working. And I go on Sundays, and when I'm under pressure, like lots of people, I pray. So, I would pray a fair bit.
Do you think it works? I mean, do you believe in the power?
I find it quite consoling, you know. Sometimes you just can't, when things are going really bad, when Nora's very not well and things are seemingly out of control, totally out of your control, sometimes I forget to pray and I wonder if there's a God there sometimes, but I know there is. I tend to pray a lot to Our Lady, you know, so I've got great faith in Our Lady.
Do you ever get angry with Our Lady or God that Orla was born with an illness?
No, but not really. I mean, what can you do? You know, Orla was born and that's it. You know, you just take what's given to you. And I think that, what can I say? Sometimes I am so angry I can't pray. And I just can't concentrate to pray. So I pray in bed at night, or, you know, I just would say the rosary sometimes to myself. Now, when we were children, my poor father, God help him, God rest him, he used to make us all kneel down to say the rosary. And we'd all be poking each other and pulling each other's hair and... So they abandoned that after a while. But I would pray, absolutely. And I'd light candles and Orla would ring me and say, "Ma'am, pray for so-and-so. You do the job there. You do the praying." You know.
What about you, Brian? Do you pray? Do you have faith? Do you feel angry sometimes? Why was it your child? Why not someone else?
No, absolutely not. I don't think why was it my child. You know, there's so many things. There are so many variables in life and so many things that happen to so many people, and look at the suffering of people in all sorts of situations across the world. To me, it's illogical. You know, as Patricia correctly says, it happened. You deal with it. That's it. Prayer, I probably pray in my own peculiar way. I suppose I believe that there is there obviously some omnipotent personage or something there that has, you know, created everybody, and that's as far as I go with it. But I totally respect people who pray, and I think people are quite lucky to believe in the power of prayer. And as you say, Patricia, the comfort that can give at particular times, that's as far as I would go with it.
And of course your son Jack and Orla's brother Jack, he's been great throughout all of this as well, isn't he?
Well, Jack is obviously, as part of the families, I think he's always been highly supportive to Orla. But he's very much his own man. We spoke about his leaving cert earlier on. He's just come back from twice this year, this summer, from Inishmore, having made a promotional video
for the
Gaelic Clochter down there, which is, you know, so he's very much his own man.
Yeah, he's so supportive, you know, and yet he treats me just like a sister. I don't get any special treatment, you know, and, you know, we give out to each other.
And they never fight.
And, you know, but he's always...
He's
had to be serious from a very young age. He's had to, you know, I remember he's asked questions about death and things like that from a very young age regarding me. And
one thing about CF is that it matures children very quickly.
Yeah.
Orla had to mature. She matured quite quickly because she was exposed to her illness, exposed to a lot of things associated with her illness. And then Jack also was exposed to Orla going to hospital, big absences in the house, you know. Yeah. So he has, both of them are matured quite early.
I mean, I was reluctant to mention that word, but you've mentioned dying and death. When you have CF, because in theory you don't live till you're 100, or like Aunt Bree we mentioned earlier, and don't go till 97. Is it something you think about all the time or not?
No, I mean...
it's there in the background, I think. With me, it's there in the background anyway. But you just get on with it.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I mean, my illness is worse the past 2 years than it's ever been. And so I've had situations where I had a bad time of it with collapsed lungs or bleeding or whatever. Mm. Last Christmas, I was in hospital for about 2 months, and it was really grim from my point of view. But then I see people with CF who go through so much worse than I do because it's such... a unpredictable illness and so individual to the person who has it, and there's so many different complications. And I think, you know, I'm worse than I was a year ago, but then a year ago that was a bit scary. Now it's worse, but I still feel great. So you just don't know, you know, and you just can't know these things, you know. And I've seen a lot of people with CF pass away, and I used to think I was invincible and I know that I'm not, but I think you just can't know these things, you know, and maybe when I need a transplant, I'll get one. Maybe I won't. And it's a lottery, really. You know, you can't, even if there's a match, you might not survive it. So it's just something that you are aware of, and you're always, I suppose, you move towards it. Every day you move towards it. But if you think every day that you're moving towards it, then you're not going to live your life. You know, you have to think of every day as positive and as something new and wonderful. That's actually why I chose the song that I chose, because I love it. It's about getting up every morning and waking up and just being thankful for the day that you have.
God, I find you so inspiring. And you don't like being called inspiring, but I do find what you say so inspiring. How's your love life, by the way?
Oh, no comment. nothing exciting going on.
Nothing exciting going on. Is it true that you're bisexual?
Yeah, sure, if you want to call it that, that's fine. yeah, totally. I started having crushes on girls when I was around 10 or something, and my poor parents didn't know what was going on. Maybe they did, I didn't know what was going on, but yeah, definitely. And I wrote about it in my book as well, and some people said, oh, you don't need to mention that, why would you mention that? I'm like, why wouldn't I mention it? If I'm talking about my relationships with men, why wouldn't I talk about my relationships with women? You know, it's just who I am. And that's the funny thing about CF as well, it just makes you see that all of this this sort of crap about, you know, you should be a certain way, you shouldn't be a certain way, that's absolute rubbish. You just be who you are, and that's it, you know.
And I know you don't like the word inspiring, but other young people reading your book who themselves might have different forms of sexuality, that gives them the courage too to be open, because there's nothing worse than living your life hiding who you are.
Yeah.
Do you think, Brian?
Really, absolutely.
As long as you're happy.
Yeah.
In one sense, you were kind of thinking that it shouldn't be mentioned, because you're mentioning something. I know that the reality is that, you know, that bisexuality or anything other than a so-called normal, you know, you talk about, but it's kind of, by talking about it, you're almost making it, you know, abnormal into some kind of a way.
Yeah. Do you introduce somebody as so-and-so is, but she's heterosexual? You know, does it matter, really?
Yeah.
As long as the person is happy and honest within themselves and believes in themselves.
And when you are honest in yourself, for me, I felt so much, so free when I came out like that. And it took a few years, because I would start coming out and then you kind of, you know, you'd almost forget that you've come out, and then you have to kind of keep coming out again. But it just makes you feel a whole, you know, your whole self, as opposed to that you're hiding something or that you feel like there's a part of you, because it makes you angry not being able to be who you are, and you should just be able to be who you are because life is so short, you know.
Yeah, no, it's liberating. I think that's what people say, is like, you only have one life. Well, I've just loved having you as my guest, Orla. Like, I mean, you're one of the most impressive people I've ever met, and I can see you're the product of Brian and Patricia, your parents, who've been wonderful parents, and your brother Jack. What's the name of the song you love that we're ending on?
Oh, the song I love, it's called Wake Up Boo by the Boo Radleys, and I really love it. I also actually really love To Kill a Mockingbird, so it's based on the character Boo Radley from To Kill a Mockingbird. But
there's three copies of To Kill a Mockingbird.
I got another one in the post the other day, actually. But I love it because it's about, you know, even though there's things that you can't control, you just get up every day and, you know, the sun is shining and you get on with things, and you know, there's so many things to do in life and you should just grasp them with everything you have.
Well, I hope everyone is listening to that message this morning. My thanks to you, Orla, to your wonderful parents, Patricia and Brian. I hope you stay healthy, like your Auntie Brie, until the age of 97. My thanks on sound today to Peter Cheevers, to my producer, Sarah Binchy. I'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we're going out listening to your favourite song.
Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.